Orders and by the local seasonal and organic delights at Farm Star Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farm Star features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts with vegan, and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open Monday through Friday for lunch, noon on Saturday and Sunday, and for dinner 7 nights a week with live music on Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Located at 2359 The Esplanade, visit farmstarpizza.com or like them on Facebook. And we're also brought to you by locally owned and operated Rescue Technology Solutions, providing on-site and remote computer repair, maintenance, and security, serving all of Northern California since 2002. Rescue Technology Solutions offers on-site and remote support, monthly maintenance services, PC repair, and virus removal. For more information, visit rescuetech.net or call 888-817-2667. And that's Rescue, RESQTECH.net. This is KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio. Welcome to Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal rights and veganism every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM or streaming online at kzfr.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Non-Human Radio. I'm Jeannie Trezino.
And I'm Danny Toms. Today we're going to take another long look at public grazing leases and some groups who are working to claw them back from the hands of entitled ranchers. We'll also hear about how the Wildlife Services Agency caused yet another tragedy, killing a dog and sending a teen to the hospital, but at least this time there was some outrage and blowback. Let's get started, Jeannie.
All right. I thought I'd share this interesting essay, a blog piece about bighorn sheep and their cousins, the domestic sheep. The essay is from the blog of an activist group called Wildlife News, which is focused on wolves, wildlife, public lands, and the intersection of science and politics and policy. This piece is by author George Werthner, who is the Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology, where he researches for the group and writes about environmental issues. So, in a recent blog piece, Werthner writes that bighorn sheep, which are named for the large curling horns of the adult rams, which is a wild species.
This makes sense.
Are one of the West's most iconic animals. The species was once found all the way from North Dakota to Washington in the north, and in the south from California to New Mexico. Bighorn sheep were among the most plentiful of the West's large mammals, with an estimated population of more than 2 million animals.
We could probably do a whole show on large mammal species that used to have a range from here to there
West,
and now will no longer exist or no longer have such a range.
That have been replaced by other grazers,
right.
And that's the argument that a lot of ranchers say to justify that their cattle are environmentally sound because they're replacing and functioning as these large herbivores, right? For me, I'd rather have a pronghorn or a bighorn sheep to a cow or a sheep any day. So anyway, today in most Western states, bighorn populations are counted only in the thousands, right? So they were in the millions, and now they're in the thousands. Mm-hmm. For instance, Colorado is home to approximately 7,000 wild bighorn sheep. Wyoming has about 6,500. Montana has about 6,000, and Idaho around 3,000, right? So these are like small populations. You can count them, right? That's sad. In California, we have two subspecies of bighorn sheep, the desert bighorn and the Sierra Nevada bighorn. And the desert bighorn is found in the dry desert mountains of southeastern California. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife actually allows hunting of small numbers of this subspecies. And on their website, it looks like about 16 animals were killed in 2015 of an already small population.
Yeah, so we've gone from millions to thousands. And we still allow hunting of them, and I'm sure if we asked them, they'd say, well, we got to kill some for their own good to protect them, right?
And the hunters pay for permits, right? So it's partly a funding mechanism also.
I thought I paid taxes to protect the environment.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So it's not clear how large that desert bighorn population is, but obviously it can't be very large. So, and as for our Sierra Nevada subspecies, in 1995, the population had shrunk to only 105 individuals compared to what were believed to be thousands in the 19th century. The first California shepherds grazing their livestock in alpine meadows in California, first of all, they encountered large herds of these bighorn, and these shepherds also brought diseases into bighorn country, much like European settlers brought old world diseases like smallpox to Native Americans. So now the Sierra Nevada subspecies is recovering from that 100 animal low in 1995 to the grand total of about 400. So, and as far as I can tell, it's not legal to hunt this subspecies, at least not yet.
There needs to be at least 500 before, you know.
Right. I mean, so these viable population is a term that biologists use,
right.
And it represents you have enough breeding animals that have enough genetic diversity so that you don't end up with what they call a bottleneck, where you end up having like these bad genes that remain fixed in a population. So, anyway, in general, throughout the West, the decimation of these bighorn populations appears to have been caused by overhunting, competition for forage with domestic sheep and cattle, but most importantly, the transmission of diseases from domestic animals to wild animals. The dominant disease threat that comes from transmission of various bacteria in domestic sheep fosters the development of a certain type of pneumonia in the lungs of the wild bighorn, killing them.
Do you know if is this benign in the domestic sheep? Or is this a case of domestic sheep being sick and not being treated and then passing it along?
I don't know that. Okay. I don't know that.
Curious.
My bad. Pneumonia has been blamed for the decline of numerous of these wild bighorn sheep herds in 19... And it's happened in our lifetime, right? These are documented cases that I'm going to talk to you now about. In 1991, there was a die-off of a third of the population of the famous Whiskey Mountain herd in Wyoming, right? So these herds, they have certain ranges and they have names, right? These are known to the people in the area. Another outbreak among a herd of wild bighorn in the Absaroka Range in Wyoming led to a loss of 800 to 1,000 wild sheep. And in the winter of 2009-2010, 4 out of 9 bighorn herds in western Montana experienced pneumonia die-off. So these are diseases that they've contracted from sheep herds.
Yeah, and I could have some, you know, understanding of this kind of transmission in the 1800s. Nobody knew. It's sort of unacceptable that this is happening now and that these herds are interacting with domestic sheep.
Yeah, yeah. Inexplicably, state wildlife agencies, their approach to stemming these bacteria, these diseases, is to actually kill the bighorns to thwart the spread of bacterial pneumonia. In Montana, ranchers are actually allowed to shoot wild bighorn if they are suspected of intermixing with their domestic sheep herds, right? So the idea is like, oh, I see a bighorn. He's in proximity to my herd. He could take a disease from my herd back to his wild herd, right? So the mechanism is to kill the wild bighorn instead of decreasing the grazing range of the domestic sheep.
And based on the way this sounds, it's based on suspicion, no real facts required. Basically, this just gives, you know, a farmer, you know, carte blanche to just shoot any bighorn he sees, have a nice trophy, and claim, well, it probably was near my herd.
Possibly. But to me, it seems more like this is a rather common way to control disease in domestic populations, right? So when you hear about a bird flu that threatens perhaps a whole shed full of layer hens or broiler hens, right? They will depopulate is the word that they use in the chicken business. They will kill the entire flock, right? If there's Britain experienced this with mad cow disease, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, where they took to killing whole herds of domestic cattle in order to prevent the spread of the disease and to start with fresh animals, so-called fresh animals. Mm. So, Sometimes farmers take more extreme measures. In 2015, so we're just talking about like a few years ago, the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Agency allowed hunters to kill half of a famous bighorn herd near, I think it's Lima, it could be Lima, Montana, with the stated goal of eradicating the herd, after which they might try to reintroduce bighorns into the area. So that's that model I just talked to you
about. So did they eradicate it, or did they just kill half of it, or they let hunters do half and then professional?
This is Wildlife Services. And they killed, in this case, they allowed hunters to take half of the herd.
Right.
And then they may come back to kill the rest.
I see.
And then they'll reintroduce other bighorn into the area. In 2016, just last year, the Nevada Department of Wildlife requested assistance from the federal agency, Wildlife Services, to kill the remaining members of a bighorn herd in northwest Nevada to keep the disease from spreading to other wild bighorn herds. All right, so they're heavily managing these wild populations. So to me, it's like Orwellian, right? It's like we must kill the bighorn to save the bighorn. And it's just frightening.
And they're not. We're paying money to do this rather than just restrict the interaction of the wild herds with the domestic herds, which are carrying the disease.
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately the source of this pneumonia in particular is domestic sheep herds.
Right.
So many state agencies are reluctant to then reintroduce bighorn into suitable former habitat if there are any domestic livestock in the area, right, for these grazing leases.
Call me suspicious, but I'm sure that this happens quite frequently where they save the herd by killing it, and then like, oops, but since they had the disease, somebody must be nearby, therefore this is just grazing land now.
Possibly, you know? Possibly. For instance, a suitable habitat in the Centennial Mountains in Colorado, on the Idaho-Montana border, is now vacant of wild sheep, even though this area once supported substantial bighorn herds. So the management decision is not to reintroduce these bighorn there. So since most wild sheep populations are found on public lands, they are under the control of federal agencies. A lot of public land is under federal control. So with that in mind, a group called the Western Watersheds Project, the Hells Canyon Preservation Council, and the Wilderness Society sued Idaho's Payette National Forest to force that agency to protect bighorn habitat. In 2008, this sounds like ancient history now, right? In 2008, the U.S. District Courts ruled that ranchers were barred from grazing sheep in the Payette National Forest. So these advocates won their battle. What's interesting is that the ruling was appealed by the Idaho Wool Growers Association and others, but ultimately that decision is held up, has been upheld, and it has set a precedent for wild sheep management on other public lands in other states. The main reason why I wanted to bring that point up is because we're talking about in this part of the country, which is Idaho, Montana, and those northern states, it's sheep growers. We're not talking about, typically when we've talked about California issues, it's been cattle ranchers. Mm. In this case, it's sheep.
This sounds like a good precedent, though, right?
Yeah, no, it's an awesome precedent. I just want to, the reason for me bringing it up is because it's, in particular, this is the Wool Growers Association, so I just want to let folks know, like, vegans don't wear wool. And you may think we're kind of crazy because, like, gathering wool doesn't hurt the animal. But in this case, the sheep hurts habitat. It comes at the expense of these bighorn sheep. And then we can talk later about the actual cruelties and injuries involved with wool, wool shearing and production.
And it stinks. I mean, it stinks and it's itchy.
Yeah, that too. Anyway, Werther goes on to write, "Livestock grazing on public lands is a privilege, not a right." And I have to say, I agree with him. To be clear, ranchers lease specific areas from the government for their exclusive use as pasture lands, and this is often at below market prices to conduct their own private business and make profit. And we've talked about the grazing numbers, like how much they're paying per acre in previous shows.
In other words, this is a transfer of wealth from the taxpaying public to ranchers.
Yep. And then the taxpaying public gets to eat this below-cost meat, right?
Right.
These products that don't incorporate all the externalities,
they're not required to sell that to America either, right? They can sell it wherever. So
that is true. That is true. Anyway, so often these leases, as we've discussed, harm other public values like bighorn sheep herds. But because grazing is a privilege, federal land management agencies can legally terminate grazing privileges to protect other public resources, other things that the public values. So we should take a look at the language that we use to describe these government leases. Ranchers often use the term grazing rights, but it needs to be emphasized that ranchers do not own the lands that they are using for grazing. And I just liked Werther's handling of this concept, right? These are public lands, and they are leased, just as you or I might lease a house or an apartment. Just because we've lived in a rental for a long time does not give us legal ownership or property rights. So long-term leases of public land grazing allotments don't entitle ranchers to any compensation should the grazing lease be reduced or closed. All right? But this is where policy meets politics, right? And where just being right or, as I say, logical isn't enough. The reality is that few federal land managers are willing to endure the political fallout that occurs whenever they attempt to reduce or terminate a grazing allotment, right? They're going to face blowback from the ranchers. They're going to face reduced income or revenue from these if these leases are terminated. And so, and we all remember the story of the Cliven Bundy, who we've talked about, who was a rancher in Nevada, who's a scofflaw, who just failed to pay his grazing fees for years, and who then mustered his own private militia rather than give up or face the consequences of breaking the law.
I believe he was let off, right, on the trial.
He has been tried, mm-hmm. and I believe he is serving a sentence.
Okay,
but it is true that federal agents back down rather than risk an actual gunfight mm-hmm. with his mostly his, a lot of it was his family members, but a lot of private militia types showed up at that confrontation. So Bowie opened up the show talking about how these rights are being clawed back, right? So one strategy that's being used is to reduce the conflicts between domestic livestock and bighorn, as well as other species, is that ranchers are being offered a buyout of their public lands. In exchange for cash, a rancher volunteers to forfeit his or her grazing privileges on the allotment, while the management agency, such as the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management, agrees to permanently close the affected lands to future livestock grazing. So they accept money. The ranchers accept a payoff, basically, to say, okay, I'm going to stop grazing my animals on this area of land. And in the meanwhile, the mediating group arranges for a decision by the agency, like the BLM or the Forest Service, to say, okay, we're not going to issue any more grazing allotments, so no one else is going to make a profit off that land. So this eliminates some of the conflicts with the bighorn sheep and other wildlife species like wolves, grizzly bears, and coyotes. And it also offers taxpayer relief because, in this case, the research that Werther has done, he found that most of the sheep ranchers also receive ag subsidies for their business. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, one example that he brings up is that there's a big sheep ranching family in Montana that held grazing allotments in an area where bighorns are shot and killed when they are near their domestic herds of sheep. And an analysis that he did of the federal records showed that his family received over $800,000 in government subsidies at the same time as they're getting paying cheap grazing fees. So paying off the family to end their grazing privileges also presumably saves the taxpayer money, because the money that they received in subsidies, that this family received in subsidies, far exceeded the amount that they paid for their grazing leases.
So it's a logical solution, if a bit unpalatable.
Yeah. Well, it's even more unpalatable because, as we'll find out, several nonprofit conservation and preservation groups have been slowly negotiating these buyouts. And the groups doing this include a group called the Sagebrush Fund, the National Wildlife Federation, and the Wild Sheep Foundation, and some other groups. So, yeah, just to be clear, the National Wildlife Federation and the Wild Sheep Foundation are actually pro-hunting groups.
It sounds like they were named by the Trump administration.
They are neither animal rights nor animal welfare organizations in any sense of the word. The Sagebrush Fund seems to be more hunting neutral. It may just be a face-saving cover, like a front group, But since its creation in 2010, the Sagebrush Fund has helped to fund voluntary waiver and retirements of federal grazing permits on over 600,000 acres of public lands. And as of November 2016, the Sagebrush Fund is involved in ongoing negotiations, they say, for an additional 2 million acres of public land grazing retirements. So that's how you claw back land, grazing land from ranchers, is you substitute it with hunting.
Yeah. That's a interesting solution. Hopefully, you know, I guess we don't have the data to know how many animals will be killed during the hunting, and is it less than killing off entire herds if they suspect a disease, but it's, I don't know, kind of a lateral move maybe.
Yeah, it's not a great solution, but I do think overall it's better than having thousands of animals grazing on desert areas, otherwise marginal lands.
Right, and certainly saves us money paying insurance and subsidizing farmers.
Yeah, so anyways, I just wanted to bring that up, and I do think our listeners should pay attention to the fact that this particular issue in some of these northern states is sheep versus bighorn, you know, sheep versus wild animals. So your choice to eat lamb at Easter, for instance, is not benign.
Right.
And your choice to wear wool is also not benign, because this is part of this system. So you're listening to Non-Human Radio with hosts Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms here on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio. Over to you, Danny.
All right. Another story that we wanted to share is just kind of over the top and eye-opening, and I hope people are listening. This is news that the horrific animal killing agency, also known as Wildlife Services, that they have yielded to public pressure and they have agreed to stop using cyanide bombs to kill coyotes and wolves. Because, you know, what could go wrong with putting cyanide bombs out across the countryside? Did you guys know that our government is paying Wildlife Services to put cyanide bombs out in the countryside? This is unacceptable. About a month ago, one of these anti-predator explosive devices, known as an M44, not a good-sounding name, it spit sodium cyanide into the face of an unsuspecting 14-year-old boy, and it killed his dog. The Western Regional Director of the USDA's Wildlife Services Agency told conservation groups in a letter dated April 10th that, quote, "The agency takes seriously the incident in Idaho. We immediately responded by removing all M44s from the area, initiating an inquiry into the incidents, and launching a review of current Wildlife Services operating procedures." The director noted that the agency has removed all M44s currently deployed on all land in Idaho and has refrained from planting new ones. He added that the agency would notify landowners 30 days prior to placing any new M44s, which sort of sounds like beforehand they didn't notify you at all.
Exactly.
Please notice that the director backed away from a nationwide ban. So they take this very seriously. So for a little while in one state, they're going to stop putting bombs out there that kill anyone that steps on them. Yet they're not actually banning it. They've only stopped this in Idaho. The move follows this incident in March of this year in which a 14-year-old Canyon Mansfield was inspecting one of these half-buried devices that looks like a sprinkler head near his family home while he's walking his dog in Pocatello, Idaho. The boy and his dog were actually on BLM public lands, which is very close to your home, kind of like if you're out here hiking and you cross some barbed wire fence and now you're on some other property. And so when they were bending over to look at it, him and his dog were sprayed in the face with this orange powdery sodium cyanide. It sent the teenager to the hospital, and it killed his dog. It's just outrageous. The teen's family and the county sheriff's office later learned that the device had been placed there by the federal government. So, often known as a cyanide bomb, the M44 is a device used by the USDA's Wildlife Services Agency to prevent predators such as coyotes from harming livestock on farm and ranch lands.
Right. So here we're seeing again, you know, this intervention, and we are running a little short on time, so I just want to like cut to the chase here. So this agency provoked enough. This is not the only incident where somebody's dog has been killed by these devices, but I think because it was just that right time.
Yeah.
It was this teenage boy and his dog dies. So agency faced a lot of blowback. It went kind of viral on social media.
We give the grazing land at below market rates. We subsidize the ranchers. with various subsidies, and we also go around, you know, dropping bombs to protect them, literally.
Yeah.
So that they can sell their product any which way they want, and there's no guarantees around it. It's almost as if there's a massive lobby from these states and these industries going on in Washington, D.C., because otherwise this sounds completely bonkers, right?
Yeah. So anyway, so long story short, yes, there's a ban on these devices in Idaho. The bigger story is that Congressman Peter DeFazio from Oregon introduced a bill to ban this device and a poison called Compound 1080 nationwide. And that just got introduced last week in the legislature in Washington, D.C. And so hopefully we'll see that going somewhere. I like the quote from DeFazio, which said, "The federal government should not be using these extreme measures. It's time to stop subsidizing ranchers' livestock protection efforts with taxpayer dollars and the unchecked authority of wildlife services once and for all." So that is a story yet to be told. I hope that I can report on some good news from that legislation in the coming probably year or two.
We hope.
We'll see. So, and now we have a little bit of the calendar of events, and then we'll wrap up. I just want to wish everyone a happy Easter. Remind folks that Sunday, April 16th, you can enjoy some vegan pancakes at the 36th Annual Pancake for Peace fundraiser for the Chico Peace and Justice Center at the Card Center at 545 Val Ambrosio between 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. I just kudos to the Peace and Justice Center for offering vegan options for folks to enjoy a peaceful Easter brunch. And then next Saturday, the 22nd, we have the Chico Vegan Potluck at the Chico Library Community Room from 6:30 to 8:30. I hope to see everyone there. We will be celebrating umami, which is the fifth taste. After sweet, sour, bitter, salt, there is the flavor called umami, which is basically...
I don't think... That's not next Saturday. 2 weeks from now?
2 weeks from now, the 22nd.
Yeah.
And then... a heads up that on April 24th, Monday, April 24th, we'll have Jonathan Balcom speaking at Chico State on his best-selling book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. That should be an excellent talk from an excellent speaker. And that is about it. If you have an event or other news to share, send an email to chicovegan@gmail.com and tell me all about it. In the meanwhile, we have one last bit of business to take care of. And that's the Animal Rights Quote of the Week.
All right. From one of my favorite authors, the Animal Rights Quote of the Week is from Mr. Mark Twain, who was certainly not a vegan, but who had a great deal of insight into human weaknesses. He wrote, "Whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect." So if you eat meat, you're obviously in the majority, but you should think about what that implies for the animals, for the environment, and for your health.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Think about bighorn sheep. Think about somebody's pet dog, right?
Think about your own children stepping on cyanide bombs.
That too.
Yeah.
Non-Human Radio is made possible through the generous contributions of KZFR listeners like you. Many thanks to Guillermo Mash of Without a Roof and Sue Hildebrand for their engineering assistance and moral support. Stay tuned for Sue's show, The Real Issue, coming up next.
You've been listening to Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, or its staff.
If you missed any portion of this show or you want to listen again, please visit the archives at kzfr.org and search for Non-Human Radio. This is Jeannie Trezino and Danny Tom signing off. Be different. Be better. Be kind.
And go vegan.